epsilon A are called parameters of the transformations. So theta mu A are killing vectors. And L A are generators. So then we derived killing vectors and generators for some particular transformations. So we considered translations for which theta mu A is mu nu is minus delta mu nu. There are four translations and labeled by the Lorentz index nu. Generators of translations are just derivatives. So this, from here you can guess that translations should be related to conservation of momentum, because the generator of translation is basically the quantum mechanical momentum operator up to a factor of y. Then Lorentz transformations for all Lorentz transformations, their parameters are anti-symmetric matrices. So the killing vector has three indices and is equal to 1/2. I believe this was, what was it, del x. Delta mu nu x lambda minus delta mu lambda x nu, and generators were equal to 1/2. I forgot what was the sign. What was it? So in the last lecture the sign was correct, but I forgot, was it this term is the plus. Other way around. Okay, so this is then with the minus. And then L nu mu is x nu d lambda minus x lambda d nu. So this is actually nothing but quantum mechanical angular momentum operator. It includes angular momentum operator because if you define ji, so I now is the spatial index, to be I epsilon I j k L j k. Okay, so this I is the complex unit and this I is an index. So this is equal to I epsilon I j k x j dk, and this is equal to minus x cross p I, which is the usual angular momentum, but it's orbital what is usually called orbital angular momentum in quantum mechanics. So it's x cross p, and this means that, okay, in the scalar field theory we are dealing with, there is no spin. So there is no additional spin term here. So the scalar field will describe particles without spin. So now we are ready to formulate the Noether theorem. So the Noether theorem is formulated for a very general field theory. So suppose that the action is a general has a local form, so it's a four-dimensional integral of some function of fields, and their first derivatives and this is invariant under symmetry transformations. With the generators L and Killing vectors theta. Then claims the theorem there is as many conservation laws associated with this field theory as there are symmetry transformations. So if parameter A runs from 1 to n, there will be n conserved quantities. And the theorem is actually constructive. So it's possible to write down explicitly what are the conserved currents of these symmetries. So then the currents which are defined as follows. So we take the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the derivative of the field. I'm sorry, so this index should be an upper index, and then there should be a lower index that labels various currents. And then we should write here L A I J phi acting on the phi J and plus theta mu A times the Lagrangian itself. So then these currents are conserved. Meaning that their three divergence is equal to zero. So d mu g j mu a is equal to zero, provided that the fields satisfy the equations of motion. So the equations of motion for this Lagrangian are, well, they are derived by varying the action, but they can be written in the very general form. Minus dl over d phi I is equal to 0. So this is the statement of the Noether theorem. The meaning of this theorem is that the conservation laws and symmetries is one and the same thing. Yes. No, discrete symmetries do not lead to any conservation laws. They lead to some selection rules, like, for instance, try to come up with some example. Like, for instance, special parity forbids certain decay process in particle physics. So, because the parity of initial state and the final state should be the same. But there are no conserved, I mean, charges, conserved currents associated with them. So, okay, so then we can, I will not give the proof of this theorem. You can look it up in the textbook or in the notes. It's a bit tricky, in fact, but pretty straightforward. So one just uses these equations of motion and shows that the invariance of the action has a, as its consequence the conservation law of the currents. Okay, so then let's apply this theorem to the Klein-Gordon field. So I remind you that the action of the Klein-Gordon field is equal to 1/2 integral d4x d mu phi squared minus m squared phi squared. And on the last lecture, we derived, okay, so we derived the Killing vectors and generators for translations and rotations. So let's just use this expressions and see what is the, what are the conserved currents. So first we consider translations. Then the generator is, so the parameter then is a four vector. The generator is the derivative and the Killing vector is just, its components are equal to delta mu. So what we find is that the corresponding current, let's call it T mu, and then nu labels various generators is equal to what? So we should write the derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to the derivative of the field. So this would be equal to d. And so in the current that comes with the index mu, dimify. And then that should multiply the generating act, the generator acting on the field, which is d nu acting on phi. And then we should add the Killing vector. So the Killing vector is minus delta v nu multiplied by the Lagrangian. So this current is concerted. It is called the energy momentum tensor. Since translations are associated with conservation of momenta, and in this relativistic setting also of energies, because time translations are dual to the to energy. So this is the current that is responsible for conservation of the of energy and momentum. Now, the four components, so this is a four, the current is a four vector. I mean, the current in the Noether theorem is always a four vector, so its zeroth component, therefore, is the density of the corresponding charge, and its special component is the density of the flux of this charge. So in particular, if we set this index to zero, and integrate over the whole space, this would be the total momentum stored in the field. So the total four momentum of the field is what? It's P, and then let me raise the index. So this would be equal to the integral over three-dimensional space of t zero nu. So explicitly, the energy of the field p zero is equal to the integral of what? So we should set both indices to zero here. And after some calculations, you can find that this will be equal to d zero phi squared with 1/2 plus gradient phi squared plus m squared phi squared. So for upon the upon a closer look at this expression, you can see that it's zero component. So zero component of the energy momentum tensor is the energy density. Okay. So and then this is basically T00, and we recognize the Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon field that we derived from canonical analysis. So for the special component of the momentum, we find that it's equal to minus integral d3x d0 phi gradient phi. And so this we can express through conjugate momentum, which we called phi. Thank you. So here are the expressions for the energy and momentum of the field. Now, the energy momentum tensor, so by the way of derivation, its two indices have very different meanings. So one index was the vector index of the current, so that it's signified what we are dealing with, so with the density of the current, which is the time component, or the flux, which is the special component. Whereas the second index was labeling various components of moment. So it's just labeling different conservation laws. Okay, but the answer is symmetric in the two indices. And that's always the case. So in quantum field theory, it's always possible to define the energy momentum tensor such that it becomes symmetric. The deep reason for that is that the energy momentum tensor is, it's the current that interacts with gravity, because the source of gravity is basically energy. So this is precisely what will stand in the right-hand side of the Einstein's equations if you couple the field to gravity. And of course, in the Einstein's equations, the two indices are symmetric. So the energy momentum tensor also must be always symmetric. And since any relativistically invariant field theory can be coupled to gravity, then the energy momentum tensor can always be made symmetric. So any questions about that? Yes.
If we define the energy momentum tensor from the first picture that we found out, from the zero, is it also always going to be symmetric in the moment, or is it not as regular?
No, sometimes it comes out not symmetric, but you can always, I mean, so the way it works is that sometimes you can add trivial terms to the conserved current that which are total derivatives, so they do not affect the conservation laws. So they integrate, you can integrate them by parts, and they are trivially conserved. They do not change the divergence equation, and so this way one can make it symmetric. So there's some subtle freedom in the defining conserved charges. Later we will see in one example how it works. Any other questions? Yes.
The kinetic energy term in the abstract, if that has a little bit of different form, then at least it would not be symmetric.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, this is another example. Yes, so we will see that. Yeah, so in the Dirac field that we'll study later is another example where one should take care about how one exactly defines the action, how one defines the current. So if one doesn't take proper care, the energy momentum tensor will not be symmetric. But it all boils down to terms that do not change really the energy of the field. So the energy of the field, of course, is defined in a unique way. Okay, so let's now proceed to quantization of the Klein-Gordon field. So how do we proceed? So here is the Hamiltonian. Okay, so P0 is basically the Hamiltonian of the field. We should replace the time derivative of phi by the canonical momentum, and then impose the commutation relations on the field itself and the conjugate momentum. So promote them to operators and impose the canonical commutation relations. Okay, and then the Hamiltonian is an operator that we want to diagonalize. And so we already know how to do it because we did, well, it's a slight generalization of the Hamiltonian of phonons. And so for phonons, we basically needed to Fourier transform all the fields. And then their Fourier modes are essentially creation and annihilation operators. So the same is true here. If you define the relativistic energy, then you can diagonalize the Hamiltonian using creation and annihilation operators. So this is basically the definition borrowed from the discussion of phonons with obvious replacements of phonon energy by this more general energy of the massive particle and a three-dimensional moment and coordinates by one-dimensional. So one can check that they satisfy the commutation relations of bosonic creation and annihilation operators. And the Hamiltonian can be written as a quadratic form in A and A dig, diagonal quadratic form. Yes. So this is the result of some pretty longish derivation, which I guess you have more or less done for. I mean, you have done this for a very similar problem of phonons, and here it works the same way. So this proves that the Klein-Gordon field describe relativistic massive particles, and because this Hamiltonian is diagonalized in the Fock space of generated by this creation and annihilation operators, and so each particle carries energy E and momentum P. Now, so this expression doesn't come automatically normal ordered. You can normal order it by interchanging these two terms. And this will generate an infinite vacuum energy, which will diverge as the fourth power of the cutoff. But we don't care, because the energy density of the vacuum cannot be directly measured. And besides, we could have started with the Hamiltonian in which this energy is just subtracted. So let me make a few remarks about Lorentz invariants. So Lorentz invariants is important once we start to defining what are the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. Of course, these eigenstates are just obtained by acting with a dagger on the ground state. But the question is normalization. So the normalization that preserves Lorentz invariants actually contains an extra factor. So the states that are Lorentz invariant are not unit normalized. They're normalized to 2 times the square root of 2 times the energy. So the claim is that this state is Lorentz invariant. Of course, normalization is a matter of convention, and we can use any normalization. But then the states will not be manifestly invariant, so Lorentz transformations will produce some extra factor. It is convenient to deal with precisely the states for the sake of Lorentz invariants. But it's necessary then to remember that these momentum states are not the same as momentum states that we usually use in quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. For instance, in comparing to non-relativistic limit, one should always take into account this normalization factor that's different in quantum field theory. So now let me try to explain why is it Lorentz invariant. This is absolutely not obvious from the definition. So the easiest way to see it is to switch to the Heisenberg representation. So far we were dealing with the Schrödinger representation of quantum mechanics. So our states were stationary, and it was other way around. So the states were stationary because they were eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, but then the operators were just time independent. And so if you would like to study time dependence, it was all defined as some evolution of states. But sometimes in quantum mechanics, another picture is useful when states or the Hilbert space is considered static, and the all time evolution is somehow transformed to the time dependence of operators. So the two pictures are related by unitary transformation. So if you have an arbitrary operator, in the Heisenberg representation, it will be equal to an evolution operator applied to the operator in the Schrödinger representation. Okay, so this is evolution operator through time t. This is the Schrödinger operator, time independent. And then we get the operator that depends on time. So in particular, we can figure out what is the time dependence of creation and annihilation operators. So I claim that they are dependent on time just by an extra oscillating exponential. So this is a matter of calculation. I don't know if you have ever done this in quantum mechanics, because this is without indices, without p. This would be just one oscillator, and this is the time dependence of creation and annihilation operators for a single oscillator. Anyway, this can be derived by just applying Hamiltonian and commuting it through the yes. Yes. Yes, because normal ordering produces a constant. And you can see that constant in the Hamiltonian always cancels through. And then as the next step, we can express then we want to do the same with the field operator. And so in principle, one can do it directly. So start with we know how Hamiltonian, you know, the Hamiltonian as a function of field and the conjugate momentum, they satisfy canonical commutation relation. So it's enough to compute the time evolution of phi, but doing this directly is a difficult exercise. It's much easier to first express phi and pi as functions of a and a dagger, just inverting these relations, and then simply substituting the Heisenberg operators for a and a dagger. So let me skip the details and just give you the result. So for the field operator, we then get that it's equal to the integral over all momenta Okay, so this is the result of the calculation. Now, the starting point here was that we treated phi as an index that labeled various degrees of freedom, and t is the parameter, if you wish, in the Heisenberg representation. But already in this formula, you see that Lorentz invariants is starting to reappear. So the, what stands here in the exponent is basically the Lorentz invariant product of two four vectors. So of course EP times T minus P dot X is just P mu X mu, right? Where P mu is defined as E and then P, right? So so these exponentials become Lorentz invariant. Now, the measure of integration doesn't look Lorentz invariant, and in fact it isn't. But if we, let's see, in fact, what we should do is we should multiply it by two by this square root and divide by it. And the ratio of d3p divided by the energy turns out to be Lorentz invariant. So to see this, we can do the following trick. So we can reintroduce the integration of the over P0. So you see that here P0 is a function of P. So energy is a given function of momentum. But we can always make it an integration variable by inserting the delta function in the integral. So we can use the trivial equality that dP0 times the delta function that imposes the correct dispersion relation however from this dispersion relation we should so this equation has two solutions right and we need to pick up only the positive sign so we need to insert the theta function and then when we integrate it with an arbitrary function of p this will be equal to 1 over 2 times the energy times this function with p0 replaced by the energy so here delta is the delta function and theta is well the step function which is equal to 1 if p0 is positive and 0 if it's negative. Okay, and then we substitute this equation here. And then we can write the field, the Heisenberg operator, as a four-dimensional integral. Okay, so you see that this expression is already Lorentz invariant. Yes. So if you integrate d xi delta function of g of xi and then some function psi, then this is equal to 1 over g prime of psi times f of psi. So the reason this g appears is that as a first step, we should change variables here. So we should write this as an integral of dg divided by g prime, delta of g, and then f of psi of g. And then we arrive here. Yes, at g of psi, some psi where g turns to zero. Sure, yes. So, yeah, it should be. Yes, there are, so strictly speaking, that should be. Right. It should be an absolute value of g prime. This? One over two EP. Yes, this is precisely what you get. I don't know why did I write this curve. Yeah, this is correct. So you say that so you have to, so you don't want the square root here, right? So you have to multiply by the square root and divide by square root. So I guess, yes, thank you for correcting me. So this is, this the absence of the square root here is precisely the reason for the appearance of the square root here. And you see that this square root is the only Lorentz non-invariant expression. The only non-Lorentz invariant term in the whole expression, because the measure is invariant, right? For volume is invariant. The argument of the delta function is invariant. Now, the theta function doesn't look invariant, but it is invariant under transformations that do not change the error of time. Because okay, Lorentz transformations, they they some subset of them doesn't change the sign of energy, so this is also invariant. Then this exponentials are invariant because they contain the product of four vectors. And so what's left is the product of creation and annihilation operator with this square root. But then, because the original scalar field by itself was a scalar, was invariant by definition, then this product must be invariant. And this is the reason why the Lorentz invariant states are created by with this, so this normalization is the one that preserves Lorentz invariance. Yes, this is a way to see how they transform. So let me talk for another 10 minutes and then we make a break, because it will be logically now okay, so so this expression is actually is a general solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, if you think about it. So of course it's an operator, but if you forget about the meaning of this A and A Degere operators, then this is what we would write if you would like to solve the Klein-Gordon equation without specifying any boundary conditions. Okay, so to check it, it's very easy. So if we apply d squared plus m squared to phi of x, then under the integral, we'll get what? So the only place where, so this acts, this derivative acts on the axis, and the only place where axis appear is in this oscillating exponential factors. And when we differentiate an exponential, we just get, well, plus minus ip instead of the derivative. So this basically becomes minus pi squared. So what we'll get is minus pi squared plus m squared. But this is multiplied by the delta function. And this is zero. So consequently, the Klein-Gordon field as an operator satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. So moreover, this is a general solution. So one way to arrive at this result, this is not a derivation, this is just a recipe. So this would be to find the general solution, find the general solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. And then promote, so this will depend on some coefficients, right? Because we didn't specify boundary conditions. So all the Fourier modes that would appear in this solution will be simply arbitrary constants. Okay, and then quantization consists in promoting these constants to operators. So we should promote Fourier modes to operators. And you can easily see what is the difference between, so some of them will be creation operators, some annihilation operators. But it is easy to see what is the distinction. So the sign in the exponent is different for these two terms. So the creation operators should stand in front of energy with the positive sign, and annihilation operators should stand in front of the oscillating exponential where the energy enters with the negative sign. So for some reason, although here the sign is positive, I think this is called, let's say, negative frequency modes. No, this is, yeah, so this is called negative frequency modes. And these are positive frequency modes. So in other words, the coefficients in front of the oscillating exponentials which have negative frequency should be said to be annihilation operators. And those where the frequency is positive, they should be regarded as creation operators. And then there is an overall coefficient of square root of 2 times the energy. And so those should satisfy the commutation relations A P AQ dagger is equal to 2 pi cubed delta of P minus Q. And so finally, Lorentz invariant states are created by operators that contain a factor of square root of the energy. So this is what we get a posteriori by going through this canonical analysis. So we made a number of steps to arrive at this prescription. So first we, starting from the action, we wrote down the Hamiltonian, found the conjugate momentum to the field. Then we imposed canonical commutation relations, diagonalized the Hamiltonian, introducing creation and annihilation operators. Then we passed to the Heisenberg picture, in which Lorentz invariants became more or less manifest. And then finally, we arrive at the representation of the field operator, where we can easily identify what, I mean, we can easily identify it with the general solution of the equations of motion. So when we'll study other types of fields, we will not go through all this complicated canonical analysis, we will use this recipe. We will just find solutions of the equations of motion, and then we will recognize in the coefficients the of the Fourier modes, creation and annihilation operators. In each case, it is possible, of course, to do canonical analysis, and this is the real derivation. But just to, well, not to go faster, we will use this recipe, which always works. Okay, so let's make, yeah.
Would phi still be a solution if we didn't have the theta function?
Then it will be, yes, it will be a solution, but then there will be a redundancy, right? So you don't need to write two terms in a Fourier expansion. You write just one. So the way, so this is a way to distinguish creation operators from annihilation operators. You say that, so in other words, you have to distinguish positive modes, positive frequency modes from negative frequency modes. And that you do by inserting the theta function. So therefore, yeah, you could have written this as a single Fourier integral, but then it wouldn't be clear what is A and what is A dagger.
So the question is, how to describe particles with in one house? The answer was found by Dirac for his equation. And so, for some nasty reasons, he wanted to factorize the Klein-Gordon operator. So, Klein-Gordon operator, if you, as usual, if you place moment by derivatives of derivatives by numbers. So this is one. In quantum mechanics, this would be the same thing. So then, the Clair coordinate operator. Let me take number of minus. It's essentially equal to p squared minus m squared. So the way to arrive at the Clair coordinate equation is to say that, okay, we want to impose the dispersion, the Einstein dispersion relation of massive particles on the field, and so we start with this. Replace P by D, and then we get Okay, so the Clair coordinate equation is basically just the differential form of this relationship, dispersion relationship for the massless particle. So what Dirac did is he said that we want to write this as a So this looks like a difference of squares, and the difference of squares you can always write, if this were numbers, you could have written this as p minus m. I guess p plus m, p minus m. And okay, this is just an equality. But now p is not a number, it's a four vector. So here we have a four vector squared minus m squared. So what does this mean, this equation? So Dirac said that, okay, this means that we should assume that p slash is a contraction of the four momentum with some reference four vector gamma. Okay. And then this will work, but if this is a constant four vector, then there is no way that this decomposition will be Lorentz invariant, and besides, it will simply not work. So the only way it will work is that if gamma is some non-commutative thing, then expanding this, so if you write, if this is non-commutative, then this will be equal to slash squared minus m squared, and that we can write as p nu gamma mu gamma nu minus m squared. So basically we need to make sure that gamma mu gamma nu is squares to g mu. But in fact this is a very too strong a condition, because you see that the product of p mu and p nu is symmetric in its indices. So this is symmetric in mu and nu. And consequently, it is sufficient to require that only the symmetric part of this product is proportional to g mu nu. So we can write this as 1/2 p mu p nu, and then anti-commutator of the gammas. And so we should require that gamma mu and gamma nu anti-commute on 2g mu nu. Then this factorization will work. Remarkably, this equation has
essentially a unique solution. One can show that just from this, that objects satisfying this algebra are necessarily 2 by 2, are necessarily 4 by 4 matrices. So the way to prove it is, well, actually, I don't know it. There is a proof in the notes and in the textbook, I think. So if you want, you can look it up. It's not very hard. It's not very complicated, but unfortunately, it's also not very illuminating. It's not useful for any further calculations. So let me skip it. So it is possible to show that these gammas are 4 by 4 matrices. Yes? No, they are infinite dimensional or 4 by 4. They cannot be 8 by 8. Well, well, up to trivial, so you can multiply them by some trivial factors. But if you want things to be irreducible, then this is the only irreducible representation. Right. So other representations are one dimension. So. Anyway, so one possibility is to take gamma 0 to be off diagonal 1, sort of the mirror image of the unit matrix, and then gamma I can be expressed in terms of the Pauli matrices. So sigma I are the standard Pauli matrices. So this is the decomposition of the matrices in two-dimensional blocks. So this is 2 by 2 matrix, this is 2 by 2 matrix, and these are all 2 by 2 matrices. And then using properties of the Pauli matrices, one can prove that this set of 4 by 4 matrices satisfies the correct anti-commutation relations of the gammas. So these gammas are therefore called Dirac matrices, or simply gamma matrices. And then using these matrices, we can write down the equation that will be first order, but on the other hand, will be in some sense the square root of the p squared minus m squared. So the Dirac equation has the form I gamma mu d mu minus m acting on the psi equals to 0. So since gammas are 4 by 4 matrices, psi actually has 4 components. So psi and gamma matrices, of course, have an extra index. So they have also these indices that are called spinor indices. And such psi is called Dirac, is called a Dirac spinner. Now, the fact that it has four components, the same as a four vector, is an accident, and spinners have nothing to do to vectors. I mean, they are not vectors. So they shouldn't be confused with, so the spinner indices are very different from the vector indices, and they shouldn't be confused with one another. So the Dirac matrices, in fact, are not unique. So one can show that one can transform them by arbitrary conjugation with some non-generate matrix S. And it's easy to see that the transformed matrices also satisfy the same anti-commutation relations. So they are not, the others are no better than the original ones. So it's, we can use whatever we want. And in principle, one may use different bases for Dirac matrices. Some of them are useful for, it's like choosing a coordinate system. Some coordinate systems are more useful for, it depends on the problem you're solving. So the same is with Dirac matrices. It depends on the problem you're solving, which basis is to use. So this particular basis is called chiral basis. And it is particularly useful for particles that have very small mass or are massless, or which have very high energies. So the opposite case of nearly non-static particles, this basis is not so useful. And sometimes one uses different bases. But anyway, so throughout the course, we will stick to this basis of Dirac matrices. And the claim is that these Dirac matrices are the same in all reference frames, which sounds, I mean, at first it seems impossible, right? So these are just numerical matrices which have a vector index. And so this vector is the same in all reference frames. How can that be? Well, the reason is that they also have two spinner indices, and spinner indices also transform under Lorentz transformations. And these transformations completely compensate one another. And we will see how that works in the next lecture. So I guess I just stop here. Yes?
Is there some reason why the second order equations for bosons and first order equations of thermals is just this?
Yeah, there is a, I guess there is a reason for that, but should be a reason. But in fact, the equations for bosons can also be written in the first order form. I don't remember how to answer this question. So there is a. Yes?
So gamma zero is Hermitian and gamma I is anti Hermitian.
Yes.
Is there a reason for that, or is that something?
There is a reason for that. It comes from the anti commutation relation. So, from the anti commutation relations. Uh, you find that, okay, so let's set both indices to 0. That's equal to 2g00. On the other hand, this is just equal to 2 gamma 0 squared. And this is equal to 1. Right? So from that, we find that gamma 0 squares to 1. On the other hand, gamma 1, 2, and 3 square to minus 1. Because the metric has components plus, minus, minus. And of course, Hermitian metrics can square to 1, but not to minus 1. So we necessarily have that gamma 0 dagger is equal to gamma 0. And gamma I dagger is equal to minus gamma I. So if you want them to have certain hermeticity properties, then they must be so the special Dirac matrices must be anti-Hermitian. Yes.
Is it also possible for the matrices to be neither Hermitian and anti-Hermitian? For example,
it is possible.
If you go to some other basis. So
if you go to other bases, they will not be neither Hermitian nor anti-Hermitian, depending on the matrix S. If S is a unitary matrix, then there will be Hermitian and anti-Hermitian. If it's not unitary matrix, then the hermeticity properties will be lost.
How can we be sure that such a matrix S exists with these properties? I mean, the gamma matrices are a representation of our Kirchhoff algebra in arbitrary dimension.
Yes.
A priori. I mean, we know that the representations have to live in space. I think it's 2 to the power of something of the natural number.
D over 2. Of, yes. D over integer part of D over 2.
Yeah. So we have some degrees of freedom, but not in all dimensions enough to satisfy that relation that we have a kind of Lorentz information acting on spin-offs.
I don't quite understand the question. So. It's always possible to construct matrices that satisfy this anti-commutation relation.
Yeah, sure. But I'm talking about the matrix S.
Matrix S is, so here, it's not the Lorentz transformation matrix.
It's a representation of our Lorentz transformation in Spinor space.
No, it's not Lorentz transformation in Spinor
space.
It's just a change of basis of the Dirac matrices. Simply, the Dirac matrices with the S will be satisfying the same anti-commutation relations. So they are no worse than the original Dirac matrices with which we started.
You are talking about another S. But later
we will also discuss Lorentz transformations, and we will use this freedom in S.
Yeah.
Is it not true that every S induces a Lorentz transformation?
It is true, but first of all, not all S induce Lorentz transformations, and Lorentz transformations also act on the index mu. And the two should compensate one each other such that the result is, again, the same Dirac matrices. So the best way to think about Dirac matrices is to think of them as arrays of numbers given from the beginning. So once we chose this basis, we just work with this basis. And then Lorentz transformations should leave them intact. And that we'll see on the next lecture. Yes?
When you wrote the Dirac equation, you took only one of the factors in the expansion, you took the minus one. What happens with the plus one?
Equation?
We started with the p slash plus m, p slash minus m.
Yes.
And then we just take p slash minus m on psi to create the Dirac equation.
Why not to take p plus m?
Yes.
One could have taken P plus M. And this would only change the sign of mass in this equation. And I think... This is the equation for the conjugate spinner. So this is related to the original Dirac equation with the minus by some discrete transformations like charge conjugation, maybe parity, time reversal. It's just a matter of convention. Yes?
Is there any, well, I guess there's a reason, but why do we call this the chiral basis?
Why do we call this a chiral basis? Well, I will explain that later, so I'll be able to answer this question. Okay, let me stop here.